in the heart of Tibet, hearing about the flight into the northern solitudes of the mystic lord of Tashilampo, a witch actually happened just 2 years and 1 month after the prophecy. Strange coincidence? But what next? Would the other prophecies also prove true? Would a hero arise in the mythical Shambhala, which modern Tibetans identify with Siberia, surround himself with an army of stern, invincible soldiers and unite all Asia under one rule? A dream, maybe, but thousands, nay, millions, dream it in the east. From Temo, we reached the sandy banks of the Brahmaputra. The large majestic river, in its setting of high hills, breathes a spirit of calm and peace which takes a firm hold of one's inner consciousness. Landscapes have a language of their own, expressing the soul of the things, lofty or humble, which constitute them, from the mighty peaks to the smallest of the tiny flowers hidden in the meadow's grass. The Brahmaputra spoke of serenity, and in this serenity all our preoccupations, fears, and cares were drowned. Amongst the interesting sights on our road, before we turned northward, following the Jayamda River upstream, were parties numbering hundreds of Bon pilgrims who circumambulated the Kongpa Bon Hill, a one of the most sacred of the holy places of their religion. The Bons are followers of the faith that prevailed in Tibet before the introduction of Buddhism. Their beliefs may originally have been much like those of the shamanists of Siberia, but it is most difficult to be certain of this, for at the time when primitive Bon doctrines existed in Tibet, writing was probably not known in the country. Consequently, there is no hope of finding any genuine Bon scriptures. The Bons themselves affirm that they possess books of a high antiquity, written before Buddhism entered Tibet. There may be something true in these affirmations, but up to the present no authentic proofs have come to light. Nowadays Bons resemble, insofar as their religious practices are concerned, the old Red Caps sect, called Nyingmangma, means the most ancient of the ancients, with the difference that they slaughter animals for sacrifices. As for their monasteries, they have copied those of the Lamas, their clergy wear a habit identical with that of the Lamaists and they style themselves Lamas as well. In brief, the white Bons are merely Lamaists who have kept a part of the old religious practices, just as the Lamaists have incorporated in Buddhism an almost equal part of the same. The black Bons are more original and nearer the primitive shamanism. Most of them are only ignorant, vulgar sorcerers, but a few interesting and intelligent men may be found here and there in their midst who hold peculiarly bold philosophical views, and some of them are believed to be powerful magicians. However, the common run of the Sons distinguish themselves from the Lamaists only by keeping their sacred edifices on the left when circumambulating these, whereas the Lamaists keep them on the right. One may add that, instead of the formula Ant Manx Padmham recited by the Lamaists, the Bons repeat Om Matri Sailendu, which some travelers have understood as Matri Matris Diadzu. Space forbids treating the subject in fuller detail. Many of the pilgrims went round the mountain, prostrating themselves at each step, that is to say that, stretching their arms as they lay on the ground, and marking with their fingers the length they had covered with their bodies, they would then get up and stand at the exact place which their fingers had touched, after which they would again prostrate themselves and measure their length once more, and so on, all the way. Lamaists performed these repeated prostrations around the monasteries containing especially holy relics, such as the grave of Tsongkhapa. During my stay at Lhasa I saw men circumambulating the sacred city in this fashion. One even hears of people who come thus from distant Mongolia to Lhasa, passing years on the road. The Bon pilgrims were mostly tall, athletic fellows with bold energetic faces. To see them stretched head downwards when descending steep, rocky slopes was indeed a striking sight. A large number of women also walked around the hill, and some accomplished the exhausting and endless prostrations with remarkable courage. We left the Brahmaputra, continuing upstream along the river Jayamda. We visited on our way the Puchung Sukhailakhang, a small gold-roofed temple with a golden altar. Then, as I made my way along the valley, I noticed the air of abandon, of ruin, which prevailed all over the country. deserted villages had fallen in ruins, the jungle triumphed, the lands which had been cleared and cultivated. Chinese posts had existed on the road, at that time the main road, which follows the left bank of the river. One could see, here and there, high watchtowers crumbling into ruins. Around them a Chinese population had settled and cultivated the country. The track along which they stood was now haunted by daring robbers from the mountains I had thought of crossing before my meeting with the strange Gompan. People of the neighboring villages had strongly advised me to cross the river and proceed on its right bank, although it was a longer way round, because the country was a little more populated and safer on that side. Yet even this bank was sparsely populated. Indeed, after Chai Meizong, we saw little but solitary forests. On that road I twice met lonely pilgrims, like the man I had seen at the beginning of my journey dying near the Kakapo, but in this case both were women. One of them, in spite of our pressing advice and the little money we had given her, did not appear inclined to ask hospitality in a village house. We left her behind, but she overtook us by walking at night, though this time she appeared to be at the end of her tether. We offered to lead her to a hamlet nearby, but she refused. She wanted to light a fire under the trees on the border of the road. Yongdan collected some wood which he placed near her, and then we went away. The last sight I had of her showed me the abandoned devotee seated next to the fire that was beginning to burn. A thin bluish spiral of smoke rose straight before her and dissolved in space, a symbol, it seemed, of the life which was about to depart. The second wanderer I met lay under a thin shelter made of branches by some half-compassionate villagers whose kindness was strong enough to help the sick and lone pilgrim, but did not go so far as to give her a corner in their homes. With the woman remained her little dog, which barked ferociously and tried its best to frighten away those who approached its mistress. The poor faithful thing was really touching. Here again I could do no more than give her a little money and pass on my way. Is there a more cruel torture than to have continually to pass on one's way, powerless to relieve the countless sorrows which lie along all the roads of the world? Jiamta, which is considered all over Tibet to be an impotent town, is little more than a village, but its situation at the intersection of the main road from Lhasa to Klumdo and the road to the Brahmaputra gives it perhaps a strategic and trading interest. Although the town is situated at a height of nearly 11,000 feet, the climate of the valley is warm and, during the day, when the sun shines, equals even in January that of summer in such European countries as Belgium. Travelers on their way to Lhasa, after having crossed a toll bridge, must appear before an official to get permission to proceed. How often I had discussed with Yongdan the best way in which to surmount this obstacle. As a rule, things appear much more difficult and terrifying in the course of such discussions than when the moment of action has arrived. To pass through Jiamta was an easy matter. We crossed the bridge, paid the toll, and were led by a boy to the official's house. I sent Yongdan in and sat down on a stone in the dust, at the door. Many people passed through the narrow street, and no one took any special notice of me. Yongdan saluted the gentleman of the Zong, or perhaps he saw only his secretary or some pretty clerk of the place. After a few minutes he came out, and we took up our loads. The dreaded Jiamta was left behind. We were now on the post road, the only one which crosses Tibet. The progress of civilization along it is seen in the shape of small buildings like shrines which mark the miles. Indeed, I took the first one I saw to be a rustic village chapel, or tsatsa house. Registered. What added to the illusion was that on some of them lay carved stones bearing the usual Ahmam Padmaham, or other such formulas, and that I could see around them the trace of circumambulation in the little path made by the feet of the devotees. It was one of these which helped me to discover my mistake. Seeing an old man walking round with a pious mien, I wished to see the picture of the deity enclosed in the little shrine. To my astonishment, I was confronted with a piece of reddish stone, on which some figures, 135, I think, were inscribed. Strange. All my notions concerning Lamaism were disturbed. It took a few minutes of reflection before the mystery of that uncommon cult was revealed to me. Never should I have thought that my Oriental researches would lead me to discover the worship of the milestone eye. Many were the sights, the talks and the observations, all well worthy of being related, which filled the last part of my journey to Lhasa. But I must omit them to make room for the account of my stay in the capital itself. Our crossing of the Kongpa Pass was saddened by a painful spectacle. A party of pilgrims, mostly women, had been robbed there of all their belongings by some of their travelling companions who had suddenly turned brigands, a thing not so rare in Tibet. Some of the unlucky women had not been able to continue their journey and had sheltered themselves in a mountain cave. One of them had a gash in her head, another had a terrible wound in the breast, the arm of a third one was broken, others were more or less injured. Their violent wretched countrymen, though hailing from the same district, almost the same village, had attacked them with spears. At a short distance from the cave the corpses of two men were lying. All this happened within 100 miles of Lhasa, on the main route. Horse soldiers could easily have overtaken the murderers, but what official would trouble himself about such a common occurrence in that lawless country? Chapter 7. At last, after 4 months of tramping, filled with adventures and observations of which I have been able to relate but a very small part, I left Dikkun one morning at dawn, and set out upon the last stage to Lhasa. The weather was clear, dry, and cold, the sky luminous. In the rosy light of the rising sun, we sighted the Potala, the huge palace of the Lamaist Trula, still far away, yet already majestic and impressive. "This time we have won," I said to my young friend. He silenced me. "Hush. Do not speak too soon. Do not rejoice yet, we have still to cross the river Kai. Who knows if there is not a post of watchmen there?" So near were we to our goal that I refused to believe failure to be still possible. Anyhow, I dropped the subject. As we advanced, the Potala grew larger and larger. Now we could discern the elegant outlines of its many golden roofs. They glittered in the blue sky, sparks seeming to spring from their sharp upturned corners, as if the whole castle, the glory of Tibet, had been crowned with flames. Our eyes fastened upon it. We walked at a good speed, for success was near and gave us wings. The valley which we followed since leaving the Balat had become quite open. The slopes which border it may, in days of yore, have been covered with forests, but not a single tree was now to be seen there, except a few that had been planted in certain gardens. Villages stood closer as we proceeded toward the capital, but I felt very astonished to meet so few people on the high less than way. I was told by country folk that a much larger traffic used to pass during the Chinese suzerainty. Their remarks reminded me of what I had observed in the Kongpa province, abandoned and ruined villages at the feet of crumbling watchtowers, and large tracts of formerly cultivated land on which the forest had again encroached. The Lhasa Valley did not present so desolate a spectacle in the part that I was crossing, but how much ground remained uncultivated on which barley could have been grown for the town nearby, where the cost of living is so high. Tibetans have lost much in parting with China. Their sham independence profits only a clique of court officials. Most of those who rebelled against the far-off and relaxed Chinese rule regret it nowadays, when taxes, statute labor, and the arrogant plundering of the national soldiery greatly exceed the extortions of their former masters. Arrived at the river, which in the winter is but a narrow stream, we embarked on a rustic ferry adorned with the head of an animal, which the artist probably intended to be a horse. A mixed crowd of men and beasts was packed on the boat. A few minutes later we landed on the opposite bank. Neither the busy ferryman nor any of the passengers had given us so much as a glance. Hundreds of ragged pilgrims cross the Kaiachu each year, and nothing distinguished us from our fellow Arjipas. We were now in Lhasa territory, but still far from the city itself. Yongdan once more repressed my desire to rejoice, even in a whisper. What could he still fear? Had we not reached our goal? And now, nature itself gave us a token of her maternal complicity. As on the night of our starting, when we disappeared in the Kakapo forests, The gods lulled the men to sleep and silenced the dogs. A miracle seemed to protect our entrance into Lhasa. No sooner had we landed than the air, till then so calm, became agitated. All of a sudden a furious storm arose, lifting clouds of dust high into the sky. I have seen the simoon in the Sahara, but was it worse than this? No doubt it. Yet, that terrible, dry-lashing rain of dust gave me the impious sign of being once more in the great desert. Indistinct forms passed us, men bent in two, hiding their faces in the laps of their dresses, or whatever piece of cloth they might happen to have with them. Who could see us coming? Who could know us? An immense yellow curtain of whirling sand was spread before the potala, blinding its guests, hiding from them Lhasa, the roads leading to it, and those who walked upon them. I interpreted it as a symbol promising me complete security, and the future justified my interpretation. For 2 months I was to wander freely in the Lamaist Rome, with none to suspect that, for the first time in history, a foreign woman was beholding the Forbidden City. The gods threw a veil over the eyes of his adversaries and they did not recognize him. So went an old Tibetan tale which I had heard long ago in the land of grass. At that time of the year, a large number of people from all the provinces of Tibet congregate in the capital to enjoy the various festivals and merrymakings, which take place there. The inns are full. All those who can vacate a room or any shelter rent them. Travelers sleep in the stables and camp in the courtyards. I could have gone from door to door for hours, in quest of a lodging, without any other result than showing myself to a number of householders of both sexes and being compelled to answer a lot of questions. Fortunately, I was spared the trouble and danger of this. The storm abated as suddenly as it had arisen. Newcomers, unacquainted with the city, we stood a little at a loss amid the crowd without knowing where to go. Unexpected help came again to me in the shape of a young woman. "You want a room, mother?" she said. "You come from very far. You must be exceedingly tired. Follow me. I know a place where you will be all right." I only smiled at her, uttering thanks. I felt rather astonished. Obliging people are many in Tibet, and the kindness of the unknown woman was not altogether extraordinary, but how did she know that I had come from very far? This puzzled me a little, but no doubt she had gained that idea from the sight of my pilgrim staff. And I was lean enough, after so many fasts and so much fatigue, to inspire compassion. Our guide was not communicative. We followed her like sheep, a little bewildered by the noise and the traffic after months spent in the solitudes, and perhaps still more bewildered by our good luck. She led us outside the town to a place from which one enjoyed an extended view of most beautiful scenery, including the potala. This detail struck me particularly, for all along the road I had wanted to get a lodging from which I could see it. I was granted the use of a narrow cell, in a ramshackle cottage occupied by beggarly people. This was indeed the best hostelry one could have wished for the security of my incognito. The idea of looking there for a foreign lady traveller would not have occurred to anybody, and the poor beggars who frequented the place never suspected my identity. The woman went away smiling after a brief farewell. All had happened so quickly that it seemed a dream. We never saw our guide again. In our hovel that evening, lying on the ground amongst our miserable luggage, I said to my faithful companion, "Do you allow me now to say that we have won the game?" "Yes," he said, and he shouted in a suppressed, yet most triumphant tone, "Lajalo. Datamk Patn. We are at Lhasa." I was in Lhasa. No doubt I could be proud of my victory. But the struggle, with cunning and trickery as weapons, was not yet over. I was in Lhasa, and now the problem was to stay there. Although I had endeavored to reach the Tibetan capital rather because I had been challenged than out of any real desire to visit it, now that I stood on the forbidden ground at the cost of 90 much hardship and danger, I meant to enjoy myself in all possible ways. I should really have felt ashamed of myself had I been caught, locked up somewhere, and taken back to the border, having only had a superficial and brief glance at the exterior of the palaces and temples. This should not be. No. I would climb to the top of the potala itself, I would visit the most famous shrines, the large historical monasteries in the Adsinia of Lhasa, and I would witness the Realuas ceremonies, the races, and the pageants of the New Year festival. All sights, all things which are Lhasa's own beauty and peculiarity, would have to be seen by the lone woman explorer who had had the nerve to come to them from afar, the first of her sex. It was my well-won reward after the trials on the road and the vexations by which for several years various officials had endeavored to prevent my wanderings in Tibet. This time I intended that nobody should deprive me of it. Lhasa, the largest town of Tibet, its capital and the Rome of the Lamaist world, is by no means a big city. It is practically situated at a little distance from the bank of the river Kai, in a large valley with a commanding horizon of high bar and mountain ranges. Still, in a country of wonderful landscapes, as Tibet is, the scenery of Lhasa would be quite ordinary, but for the huge palace of the Dalai Lama erected on the Tsipotala, one of the two summits of a small, isolated ridge that shoots up in the middle of the valley. The other summit is called Chogbur and is crowned by the buildings of the Clerical Medical College. Better than any description, pictures can give some idea of the gigantic edifice, but even the best photograph will fail to convey a true idea of its imposing appearance. As it stands, a red palace capped with golden roofs, uplifted high in the blue sky, on a shining pedestal of dazzling white buildings. With the riches contained in that enormous cluster of habitations, rising one above another, without any order or plan, on the slope of the Tsipdala, there could have been built a real wonder palace, but Tibetan architects never were artists. The most precious materials, when handled by their rough hands, succeed only in expressing might and wealth and fail to reach beauty, yet that barbaric treatment of silver, GCDD, and precious gems gives the temples and palaces of Tibet a peculiar character, in harmony with the rough in which they stand. And this, in itself, makes a powerful impression. Chinese painters or students of Jinwat are responsible for a great part of the Potala's decoration, as well as that of the Jokang, the holiest temple of Tibet. One could spend weeks in the many galleries and corridors of the Dalai Lama Palace, reading in pictures on the walls the legends of gods and the lives of saintly men, gracefully and wittily rendered in millions of tiny figures full of lifelike animation. Here and there amongst the apartments are scattered a large number of Lhakang, gods' houses, in which may be seen a variety of images of all the symbolic and mystic deities of Mahayana Buddhism. Most of them are sumptuously decked with golden ornaments inlaid with turquoise, coral, and precious stones. A special room contains the images of the previous Dalai Lamas, and the present one is seated amongst them, but in miniature only. Darker recesses are devoted to some of the aboriginal gods and demons of the pre-Buddhistic religion, which Tibetans have never been able to forsake. A few words about them may perhaps not be out of place here. The story of the admission of these personages into the Lamaist pantheon, as told in the old books, is always the same. It depicts the struggle of the Indian missionaries, or the first Tibetan members of the Buddhist order, against beings who opposed their preaching and harmed their converts. These holy men were always endowed with magic powers, and when they succeeded to a certain extent in conquering their malignant enemy, they took advantage of his momentary defeat to extort from him the oath to renounce his hostile state of Ainind and to become a protector of the Buddhist doctrine. In exchange, the title of Choskyong, protector of the religion, was bestowed upon the god or the demon, and a place was granted to him in the temples. The marketplace the stand as a substitute for the more realistic and bloodier sacrifices of the pre-Buddhistically cult. It is only, so Tibetans believe, strict attendance to their needs, and a due reverence, that keep human beings and animals safe from their ferocity. Other dread malevolent and invisible ones are chained by the power of magic charms, and a perpetual watch has to be kept in order that the spells and other occult devices, whose strength prevents the dangerous beings from escaping, shall be recited and performed at the right time. Needless to say, all these rites have nothing to do with true Buddhism, which does not admit of any rite at all. But in Tibet they are favored even by the literati, For, so these say, such performances suit their country and the mental level of its masses. Be that as it may, all kinds of worship are practiced in Lhasa, even in the palace of its king, as well as all over Tibet. The Potala contains sumptuous suites of apartments, and the upper terrace, on which stand Chinese pavilions, could be made into an ideal roof garden, such as the world has never seen, but the desire, or even the idea, of creating such a thing has probably never entered the minds of any of the Dalai Lamas who have successively sat upon the throne of the Potala. From the top of the palace, the view embraces, in front, the whole of the valley, with Lhasa outspread in the plain. Behind it a desert extends for a long distance, until a high range rises suddenly like a cyclopean wall. Seated at its foot, the large monastery of Sera, the Hale, snowy white, rears red temples and golden roofs like the Potala itself. Its mandala are a formidable power in the state, which even the master of the Potala must reckon with. The comic element which had been to me the breath of life, even in the midst of my most trying circumstances, did not desert me at the gates of the Potala. The story of my visit to the Tibetan Vatican may well be worth the telling. As the future was uncertain and my incognito precarious, prudence advised me to hurry, apth my sightseeing tour, and to begin with the most T-vertical bar at and places of interest. I therefore decided that, before anything else, I would visit the Potala. As I was on my way with Yongdan, I thought it would be safer for me either to join some pilgrims or somehow to manage to enter the palace with a group of people. The unquestionable authenticity of real Tibetan companions would save me from suspicion. Unfortunately, we did not meet any Dokpas or other border folk, and I was already resigned to proceeding with Yongdan alone when I noticed two men, clad in the plain white dress of coarse serge worn by country folk, strolling at a little distance from the first gate. "Let us take those men with us," I said to Yongdan. "How could we ask them such a thing?" He replied, "Perhaps they do not wish to go to the Potala." "Let us try," I continued. "They look just the dear, good, stupid fellows we need." In a few words I instructed Yongdan in the part he was to play. At that moment a group of workmen came along, carrying huge trunks of trees. People threw themselves hurriedly aside to get out of their way, and Yongdan took the opportunity to give one of the peasants a push in the back. "Atsi," he exclaimed, politely. "I did not see you. No harm, Lama," answered the man. "Where are you from?" inquired my companion, in the patronizing tone of a full-fledged denizen of the capital speaking to country folk. They gave the name of their village and informed us that they had come to Lhasa to sell barley. They had finished their business and now thought only of enjoying themselves a little in the big city, before leaving on the morrow. "You are going to meet the Potala," said Yongdan, as if quite sure of what he was saying. The men confessed they did not intend to do so, as they had met it on several occasions already. Then Yongdan, speaking with the authority of one of the monks of the Potala, told them of the religious merit that such a visit produced and said that the new year was the proper time to perform meritorious deeds. Rather than loitering in the streets, drinking spirits in the public houses, they ought to pay reverence to the Potala shrines. Assuming an air of profound compassion and kindness, he added that, as they had been brought together, he was willing to lead them around the shrines and tell them the names and stories of the deities. This was, of course, a wonderful opportunity. The faces of the two simpletons were beaming and they followed the Lama, rejoicing and thankful. Like all Tibetans, they were very religious-minded. Behind them, full of confidence, I climbed the long flight of steps and reached an upper gate. The three men walked in first, strong in the superiority of their sex. I was about to follow humbly, when a boy, 10 or 12 years old, a novice Lama, short and fat, with a red face, flat nose, and large ears, looking like a gnome in a clerical robe twice too large for him, stopped me. He was acting as doorkeeper, and he ordered me rudely to take off my fur-lined bonnet, such headgear not being allowed inside the Potala. What a calamity! I had forgotten that these bonnets were not allowed there. I had worn mine a long time, in fact ever since it had been sent, by some friends from an invisible world, to provide me with a most useful piece of disguise. It screened my face and I felt protected against detection when I had it on my head. What now? My hair had resumed its natural brown shade,